We're recording.
Excellent. So I think we should just introduce ourselves for the recording and then we can get started.
Sure.
So I'm Anne Greenleaf and I'm one of the interviewers.
I'm Millie Lake. I'm the other interviewer. It's the 1st of September 2010. If you could just state your name.
And I'm Mark Emmert, President of the University of Washington.
Okay, so I'm just going to get started with some basic questions and then Anne will follow up with some other questions if we have time. Basically, we'd like to hear you tell us in your own words how the process with Nike unfolded from beginning to end, and we thought perhaps you could start with how the matter initially came to your attention and what the key issues were at that stage.
Sure. Which of the Nike situations are we talking about? The relationship overall or...
Right.
Okay.
I think Margaret is perhaps most interested in the case that ended with the settlement, so that would be the Hugger and the Vision Tech.
Yeah, the most recent one.
Well,
my engagement with Nike has been a long-standing one. Nike has been working with universities, of course, for a long time around various licensing agreements. So I have familiarity with them from other universities I've been at. When I came here, my engagement was limited to the questions of the existing agreement that we had with them that was about to be renewed, our code of conduct, the committee that at that time had been, we simply had a licensing committee that dealt only tangentially with the code of conduct issues, and it wasn't clear what their role and responsibility was. So I'd asked, Margaret was involved, and I asked Margaret and others to help recraft what that committee could and should look like so that it could be more actively engaged in these kinds of questions and have it formally inside their portfolio, because before they'd been advising the president's office, but without portfolio largely, right? It wasn't hadn't really been a formal part of their charge. So I did that. I don't remember. You probably have these records somewhere. Margaret does. I don't remember exactly when that was done, but a couple of years ago. And so with that change and the reappointment of individuals to that committee and the work of the student labor action programs out there.
I think project, I guess.
Mm-hmm. As well as the work of the WRC and to a lesser extent, in this case, the FLA, the committee brought to my attention the nature of these problems. The SLAP student group also did as well. I had a handful of meetings, I've forgotten how many, with student groups on this particular case, I think just one, had a fair amount of communication from them, all of which I turned over to this committee and predominantly then awaited their advice. It's a long-winded introduction of how we got to the beginning of this.
Yeah. Okay. No, that helps. And could you then maybe tell us a little bit about the impact of the student groups on the decision-making process and what decisions you made during that sequence?
Well, I think for me the most important role that the student group played was to keep this issue sort of on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Their ultimate impact on the decision itself was limited, because I really turned to the advisory committee for their recommendations more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did do that was useful to the process was keeping it on the agenda.
What was sort of the most effective way they did that for you? What communication did you feel was actually useful, or what communication do you think didn't work so well?
Yeah, well, the parts that don't work so well with me, so this is just a personal bias, is written communications in the form of demands and pretty almost histrionic language. That, in fact, has a very negative impact on my approach to these things. It makes me want to be less collaborative rather than more. What I found most effective were conversations that I might have with one or two of them.
Mm-hmm.
These are hard things to do in large groups, so I've met with them as in groups a couple, three times. Those are useful, I guess, for venting emotion and for feeling a sense of engagement, but they're not forms within which you can get much done.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the communications that I had with a number of the student leaders in that organization are very thoughtful, bright people, and when you see that, and when you see that they're mostly interested in really solving a problem, that's useful and effective.
Mm-hmm.
What's least effective is anything that conveys the sense that this is more about the process than it is about the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Social movements of any kind occasionally attract people who are more interested in the social movement than fixing a problem.
Right.
And like all organizations, they have a few of those.
Yeah.
And that's not particularly effective. And then you leaders, at least in my own case, want to distance them. Am I talking loud enough?
Okay, sure. So,
you know, leaders then want to distance themselves from that instead of embracing.
Right.
And so, to the extent I found them thoughtful, deliberative, passionate's fine. I like passionate.
Mm-hmm.
Concerned. That's very constructive. And bringing constructive proposals forward.
Mm-hmm.
When it becomes histrionic, emotional, threatening, demanding, then it evokes a negative response, and then you have to say, oh, okay, well, I'm certainly not going to make it look like I've been beaten into submission.
Right.
So then it slows things down rather than accelerating. So having them keep this on the agenda is, I think, a very constructive thing. Even when it's kind of annoying. But, you know, not in a bad way. But just like, oh yeah, right, I got to pay attention to this. That's constructive. Having a few bright, articulate spokespeople, mm-hmm. I think, is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, not so much.
There was one student representative of SLAP on the actual board, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
And how was your relationship with her? Did she put forth any particular constructive
goals? Yeah, I don't know. So the truth is that I intentionally stay away from those meetings.
Okay.
So I never sat and participated in those meetings. I didn't want to. I think it's inappropriate for me to do so.
Mm-hmm.
What was important was that person was there.
Right.
And I could check with Margaret, for example, as chair, and say, well, is everybody participating? Is this committee working well? And she can say, yes, this is working mm-hmm. great. And I was relying upon that committee then to include all those voices.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume the answer is yes, but I don't have evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We wondered if you could, I think we'll come back to some specifics of this if we have time at the end, but
sure.
We wondered if we could hear you talk a little bit about your interactions with Nike
mm-hmm.
over the course of this process, and particularly following the recommendation from the committee, from ACTL, what your interactions were with Nike up until this session.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, part of this process that's very important, it's not unlike my description of the interactions with SLAP, is that There's constructive engagement, and then there's kind of pointless disengagement,
mm-hmm.
and the balance is a fine one between, you know, encouraging, even nagging, right, and keeping the issues on the agenda, but not doing so in a fashion that so alienates the people whose behavior you're trying to change that they just say, well, there's no pleasing these people, and we give up.
Mm-hmm.
So as I look at Nike, and based upon what I've read and what I've seen over the years, while these issues come up with Nike, Nike is trying earnestly to grapple with a very, very difficult set of economic issues. And so to me, continuing to stay engaged with them becomes critical. If you, one of my concerns about, for example, canceling our contract with them was, once you do that, you now have no leverage whatsoever with them, because
mm-hmm.
now you're not even talking,
yeah.
right? It's like in international diplomacy, right? So, you know, when do you talk to Iran and when do you tell them to go away? It's an interesting. I don't mean to compare Nike to Iran, but you know the concept's the same. And when do you apply some kind of sanction, but not the death sentence, if you will? And so as we worked through a number of these issues, I built a relationship with Nike over a number of years, and had at one time talked to some of my fellow presidents who were having similar concerns and issues, and we'd all gone down to Nike and met with all of their leadership. I guess Phil Knight wasn't there, but everyone other than Phil, he was out of the country. And talked about these issues with their people, and we had a very, very good all-day-long meeting down at Nike headquarters. They understood our concerns. We got to learn theirs. And more importantly, I think it built some good working relationships and some lines of communication. Margaret has some lines of communication. Some other members of the university community have lines of communication. And then I did as well at the most senior levels. So what I was able to do leading up to and through all this, even before the committee's recommendations and beyond, was to make sure that they understand this, that we were serious about this. Mm-hmm. You know, to informally communicate, you know, this isn't just a group of rabble-rousing students. This is something I take very seriously, and we need to make sure that we can find a resolution to this. We don't want to find ourselves in a position where we have to toss you off campus. Mm-hmm. So work with me to avoid that, please. And they were very responsive. You have to also recognize that Nike, like the university, like any big organization or nation state, isn't monolithic. Right? There's lots of voices and there's lots of opinions. And so just as if Nike called up the UW, if they talked to a committee member, they'd get one point of view. If they talked to the athletic department, they'd get one. If they talked to a student on the street, they'd get one. If they talked to me, they'd get one. And Nike's no different. So we also needed a way to sort of triangulate positions and opinions, because mm-hmm. we'd hear in one place, well, there's no way we're going to do this, and another one, well, no, that would make some sense. And so we realized that we had to get them to kind of settle on an agreement as well. So with some face-to-face meetings, a couple of those, and several phone calls with senior Nike officials, I was able to discuss these matters, communicate the seriousness of our intent, communicate our strong interest in being helpful to them as well, because you know their situation is an interesting one, in that they don't want to deal with sweatshop labor. That's not what they want. On the other hand, They do have to worry about costs and a variety of other things, or their competitors who don't care about working with sweatshop labor will in fact undercut them, and so they work in this highly competitive environment. Nike winds up being much more closely scrutinized than any other enterprise in the clothing manufacturing business, because they work with colleges and universities and because there's people like you. Mm-hmm. But nobody's doing this for REI. Mm-hmm. Right? So I know a lot of REI clothes. I have no clue where they came from. Mm-hmm. Not the slightest clue. Neither probably does North Face. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they know or care. I probably shouldn't say companies, but most other companies. Nike does, at least in the collegiate world, care a lot about that. So that makes them potentially a good partner. So we want them to be successful so that they in turn can then we can turn to others, and they in turn can turn to their competitors and say, no, 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 we play by the rules, you need to also. Mm-hmm. I'm way off your question, sorry.
This is brilliant material and leads into some of our later questions, actually. So just on that, if it's okay to jump here, what do you think were the key factors in Nike's decision to settle in July, and what impact do you think the universities played?
I think the universities, us and others, had a very significant impact on it. I don't want to say it wouldn't have happened otherwise, but that may have been the case. So I think here's a situation where the universities collectively, and students and staff and others, had a very positive impact on, if nothing else, the lives of a good number of people in Latin America. So they were clearly, Nike, were clearly concerned that they not have their contracts broken. And candidly, especially with us.
Mm-hmm.
So Wisconsin did. But Wisconsin's not a Nike school.
Right.
So I'm not being critical of Wisconsin. Probably the right thing for them to do, I suppose. But that was a very easy call. Not an easy call here.
Mm-hmm.
Nike recognizes that we are the dominant institution in the Pacific Northwest in their backyard.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Cornell said they were going to pull the plug. Cornell's not exactly a athletic powerhouse, so it did not have the same kind of purchase on Nike as we did. So they were very, very anxious to know what we were going to do.
Okay, I have a couple of other questions, but I don't know if you want to
ask
anything. So one thing that we were interested in is if you could just speak a little to the UDub's code of conduct with regard to its suppliers and what obligations Nike had under the code of conduct, according to you.
Yeah, well, you obviously have the code of conduct, but I think while our code doesn't go as far as, you know, SLAP, for example, would like, or even the WRC, I think it's a good, sensible place for us to be right now. Over time, should become more aggressive, maybe. But for the state of the industry right now, I think it's a very good spot to be in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very supportive of it. From the evidence that we saw, that I saw, that the committee saw, Nike admitted that they clearly had violated this notion of keeping us informed of where product was being made. And while that's, one can say, well, it's a bookkeeping error, and it probably was. I'll take them on their word for that. It's a non-trivial bookkeeping error, because central to all of this is, in fact, knowing where your products are being made. And if you lose track of that, then any chance of enforcement kind of goes out the window. So I have some level of confidence, high level of confidence, that Nike is being attentive to that.
Mm-hmm.
If for no other reason, then it's relatively easy to check up on. You know, the second one, in terms of what really happened, were our products being made in either of those two factories, and they claimed they weren't. They claimed that there largely weren't any collegiate product being made there. At the end of the day, I guess my answer is, who knows? That's a question we'll probably never know. But they didn't ever deny, because I think this was genuine on their part, that what happened there was wrong. And that these employees were wronged. They didn't deny that. They said, yeah, that's right. These people have been mistreated. No question about that. It's who is responsible for that. They do have this interesting problem of precedent that if we do this, you know, and you know, now we're saying to all of our employers, I mean, our subcontractors out there, oh, don't worry, we'll backstop you whenever you stiff your employees. That's what they're most afraid of, is they're given a green light to a lot of other people who do bad things. And that's an understandable problem for them. So I was not fully optimistic that they were actually going to ever write a check. They were talking about a number of other solutions, some of which I would have found acceptable. But at the end of the day, I was delighted where they wound up, because I think that was a hard call for them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can just follow up with that. So there were a couple of components to the final settlement that they offered in July, which was the cash lump sum.
Right.
And then there was the health care extension.
Yep.
And then there was also priority job rehiring.
Yep.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about how, I don't know how involved you were in creating the final package or negotiating that with Nike, but what part of that was most important to you? What were you hoping to see in the final package?
I was hoping for all three, so that was really terrific. No, we weren't involved in the negotiating of that at all. So what they had to do was they had to negotiate with that local labor union, the name of which escapes me right now, down there. So this was a local negotiation. What they knew from us was that if the local labor representatives were willing to sign off on it, then odds are we would be satisfied as well. We didn't say that's all you have to do in our mind, but if the local representative said, our people are being made whole, then I probably would have said, well, who are we to argue with that? Mm-hmm. So the negotiations occurred at that level. I had, in talking with individuals with Nike, I knew that those three pieces were on the table, mm-hmm. and they varied a lot over the course of time in how they were going to be pieced together. Mm-hmm. The Nike folks were very nervous that would become a public conversation and then the negotiations would get derailed. So I was not in a position to discuss it with anyone. But that's another piece, I guess, that's important for this report, is that the nature of this kind of process and negotiation does enter into periods where confidentiality is essential. Mm-hmm. And while that doesn't make all the players happy, students, I know, were unhappy that I wasn't sitting down and telling them what was going on, it was simply impossible to have done so. To do so would have derailed mm-hmm. the process, and the outcome that we all wanted wouldn't have occurred. So there needs to be, if I was looking at this as an exemplar for going forward, there needs to be some general understanding that at some points in time, people are going to have to sit down in a closed room and work this out.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you would have hoped for additionally that wasn't in the package?
I think under the circumstances, that was a great outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can sit and say, oh, it would have been nice to have this or that, but realistically, I was very pleased when they mm-hmm. reached that final agreement.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think, that's probably about. I just wanted to, you've touched on this a little bit, and you've talked about your interaction with SLAP and with the advisory committee mm-hmm. here. Are there any other stakeholders, such as the Workers' Rights Consortium or the FLA or the local union in Honduras that you had interaction with in this process?
No, I didn't. I rely on the committee and those staff people to have those interactions. I think it's really critical that the president or any senior administrator have an arm's length relationship to those conversations, so that when they come to me, I don't have a vested interest in it. So if I sat and worked on negotiations on a deal, I would have been strongly inclined to say, well, of course I love the deal, I did it, instead of being able to say, oh, let's look at this and make as objective a decision as you can.
Right. Do you have anything else to follow up? Yeah, I think we have a couple other ones. Let's just check these off. So it sounds like you had an early concern coming in as president, since you're restructuring the licensing committee and wanting to sort of bring that in with the code of conduct and make that important at the UW. Sort of what inspired you to take a leadership role on these kinds of issues?
Well, some of them were already on the table when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I was familiar with all these issues because they've been national and every university has them in varying degrees.
Right.
So when I arrived, we already had another case underway. We'd had one come in also, the Russell case.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that was after I reformed mm-hmm. the committee. My timeline gets a little fuzzy here.
Mm-hmm.
But so there were a few things and a few smaller ones that were pretty lively. And it became clear right away that we just weren't structured in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee itself was pretty good about asserting that they needed perhaps a different, more formal role. Because
mm-hmm.
I was asking them to give me opinions on some things, and they'd say, well, yeah, but that's not in our charter. That's
right.
And so I changed the charter. Mm-hmm. And the committee, in large part, redrafted it for me, knew what I wanted. I edited it a bunch of different times, and wow, that was something that works.
And we've heard about about Cornell and Wisconsin in this process. Mm-hmm. Were there other universities or schools that you had conversations with during this process?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. Well, did I have direct conversations?
Or that were important?
Well, I was curious to know about the decisions at North Carolina, who who determined that they weren't in violation of their code, mm-hmm. and also another school, Purdue, I think it was, yeah.
That sounds right.
Who concluded, no, they're fine with this. Mm-hmm. So I had some people gather some information about those conclusions. I spoke with the Chancellor of North Carolina when he and I were at a meeting together about some of these things. And when university presidents get together, you know, this is occasionally a topic of conversation. And so at an AAU meeting where all of us would be gathered, you know, I chatted with the president of Cornell, who's a friend. And so then I talked a couple of times with the Chancellor of Wisconsin, who's also someone I know well. So soliciting advice or just learning the lessons of other schools is helpful. I would have liked to have seen a bit of a more collaborative model among the Pac-10 schools. We talked about that at one point. And the reality was, you quickly realized that they all have different interests and different ways of trying to handle these things.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, in terms of your interactions with Nike in particular, what do you think facilitated a good working relationship between the UW or the other colleges and Nike? Were face-to-face meetings particularly important, or what sort of facilitated that working relationship?
I think the face-to-face meetings were invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just about building a relationship so that you start to develop some level of trust with each other. So they know both my seriousness and intent, but also my inclination to work with them. And so we were all very frank with each other, saying, look, we like Nike, we want you to be a part of we want to continue this relationship, but under these circumstances, we just can't do that. So I would often frame it in the context of, don't put me in a position where I have to throw you off my campus.
Right.
And right now you're doing that.
Yeah.
And they in turn would say, well, here's some things, we just you know, we can't write them a $3 million check. Okay, then what can you do? And mm-hmm. then they start working from there.
Mm-hmm. What would have been the likely alternative or the repercussions for you had the contract actually expired and the settlement hadn't been reached?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was one of the hard parts of the calculus I knew what answer led to. I didn't know what the other answer led to exactly.
Right.
It probably some great cries of hypocrisy, because remember I assume you're aware of this, we have two relationships with them. One is the relationship with the athletic department, which wasn't in question.
Right.
It was the licensing of the shirts you and I buy at the store.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could have said, oh, we're yanking our license, and then everybody would have gone to the first football game and seen Nike swooshes all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, what's this about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't make sense. So I think it would have added a lot of confusion. It would have, I don't know what it would have done to our relationship with Nike if they would have immediately fixed it and then come back and reapplied like mm-hmm. Russell did and
right.
was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Don't know. Glad we didn't have to find out.
Right. Were there other vendors that would have been under consideration if you'd had to replace Nike?
Well, you know,
or did it sort of not really get?
Yeah, again, see, on the licensing side, Nike doesn't have an exclusive license, so you know, other people would have just stepped in who mm-hmm. have licenses with us, and they would have just, so the bookstore would have just bought more Adidas stuff, I guess, or
yeah.
Russell, but
sure.
the other suppliers would have stepped into that void, I suspect. One of the problems, though, is that Nike, because it's the 600-pound gorilla here, gets a lot more attention, and I don't know that our other vendors aren't doing everything perfectly, but the truth is, WRC and others don't go and look because they're so small.
Mm-hmm.
But once they became a larger vendor for us, I would have said, now make sure they're doing it right. And, you know, so it's a little unclear to where that would have led.
Okay. Yeah.
And do you think this decision had an impact on any of the other suppliers and their practices? I mean, what do you think? other repercussions.
I hope so. I hope that, you know, in an ideal scenario, I hope the other vendors were looking at this and that they start to self-police more effectively. And similarly, I hope that it kind of empowers Nike to hold its competitors to a higher standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you probably need a situation where people in the industry are basically ratting each other out.
Right?
Yeah. So if Nike knows a vendor down the street in Honduras closed down and stiffed their people and they hear all about it and they say, oh, that's company XYZ, they make t-shirts for so-and-so, that we hear about it.
Because
we don't want to, just because Nike's the biggest, is that we don't want them to be the only ones who hold accountable. And now that they've reconciled this issue, we want to, you know, you need to hold people accountable for good behavior, but you also need to reward good behavior.
Right. Yeah. I just want to go back really quick to the code of conduct issue. So it seemed pretty clear that under the UW code of conduct. Nike was in violation by not necessarily reporting the origin of all the apparel that was being produced.
Mm-hmm.
But there were sort of claims by some advocates that, you know, it was their responsibility to provide the severance pay and that under the code. And sort of what was your perception of that?
I think there was legitimate ambiguity about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end, Nike took responsibility for it, which was great.
Yeah.
And so I think it was, again, legitimate ambiguity, and I suspect Nike concluded that while they could make a quasi-legal argument that they didn't have an obligation, in the end they still lost the argument.
Right.
Because they lose in a court of public opinion and in that thing. And,
yeah.
And so there was no point in arguing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's pretty much it for my questions.
Thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
Is there anything else that you wanted to raise that we haven't perhaps covered in our questions? Mm-hmm. Or
no, I think you covered it well.
Okay.
Good project.
I think the last question off the record was just that.